Yes, Japan. So Japanese bands still have the best names. I think we can agree there. But you know, going back to this whole like digital versus analog thing, David, you used to work at a major tech company. Whether we can say its name or not, I don't know. But now you work for an analog fashion company. Is that like is that a statement? What's going on in your life that way right now?
There are different kinds of jobs, but yeah, I mean, I worked for Google for 13 years, and yeah, I mean, I was there when it was really growing, and there's a lot of exciting things going on. It's just in a different place than it was. And when I joined, there was like 20,000 people. When I left, it was like 170,000. So right. It just became a very big company. Now I'm on the board of Otsumo, which is the company responsible for the brand Human Made, which is designed by Nigo, who was the founder of A Bathing Ape. He's also now the designer for Kenzo. But yeah, it's very analog, but it's very kind of taking that Japanese system of doing the drop model of clothing and doing it really successfully and really globally. But I guess the thing that's interesting to me is when I got into Bathing Ape or was, you know, studying all of that in 1998 or so, you just like couldn't buy any of it overseas. It was just impossible. And no one was really coming to Japan. And so more or less whatever was happening in Japan was for a Japanese audience and nobody knew about it. And now it's like my mom sends me articles all the time of like, oh, did you see Nigo just appeared in this Hypebeast article? It's like, yeah, I saw it, mom. I said, this is my job.
Mom, stop talking about Hypebeast.
Seriously. But you know, it's like the amount of information, the flow is like instant, right? There's just no barrier. And then there's so many people coming here all the time, especially from Asia, that it's a real global system. So it's interesting. It's a lot different than it was.
Was Japan better when you had to find it? Like when you had to like seek it out, you know, now it's just like everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the big debate about culture is that we all, if you like a fashion brand and you like music, your feeling about it is that I like this music because of the music itself. It's like the intrinsic value of it. Or I like this brand because the clothing are cool. But at the end of the day, like the scarcity does affect the way that we perceive it. And so every single person who grew up in the 90s remembers how infrequently you would get a piece of new music, like a new CD or something, because it was expensive, it was hard to get, and you would listen to it over and over again, even if you didn't like it, because you didn't really have that much choice. And then you would end up liking it and attaching more value to it. And now when everything's at your fingertips, where you can like literally skip a track, like, I don't like this, go to the next one, and listen to the entire archive of recorded music forever, you know, none of it has as much value because there's no scarcity to it. And so that does just enter into how we value culture. And my friend Kyle Chaika just did a book, came out last week, called Filter World. That's all about how algorithms push us culture. And that's one of his conclusions too, is just that like, if the algorithm is just giving you something, you're just not going to value it if you had to search for it. So if you were into Japanese pop culture in the 90s, it was so hard to get any information. If you wanted to listen to Japanese music, it was basically impossible unless you came to Japan. And so the good news is that's not true anymore. People have access to these things, but some of the appeal was that it was hard to get. I mean, it's just, you can't separate that out of the human experience.
It's interesting because there's definitely like a, you know, like the Walkman changed music and stuff like that. But yeah, the iPod was a really big deal, but I think a much bigger deal was that shuffle function, like you're talking about. Like my music listening style just completely shifted overnight with that, where like, you know, you used to like, oh man, I don't feel like getting up to like change the CD or change the album or whatever. And now you can just instantly zap through stuff at like a rapid speed. And I don't know, I think it made me less, what's the word? It kind of wrecked my connoisseurship of music in a lot of ways. I don't know.
I mean, a secret that I think is actually scientifically proven, and if you know, you know, but you more or less can't form an opinion on a song until you've heard it three times. And usually you don't really love it until you hear it three times. Like the first time you hear it, you're like, that's interesting in some sort of objective sense, but you probably won't remember much of it. The second time you're like, okay, I'm starting to kind of sense what the song is about. And by the third time, like the pleasure aspects of your brain light up, like as you hear it.
Unless the song is Just a Friend by Biz Markie, which I think hits it out of the park
the first time. So the problem is that if we're just shuffling through music so much, and like, let's say it's on a, you know, playlist, you're not going to have that, listen to it three times and remember it. And then, you know, I download a bunch of stuff and listen to it once. I was like, that was cool. And then I have like a backlog of 20 other things to listen to and don't get around to it. So it's a hard challenge at the moment to stay focused and to repeat things when you have infinite supply
of creepy nut songs.
You would love it if you just had that third.
Why did you stop at the second listen, Patrick? Otherwise, you know.
The other funny thing at the moment moment. I'm just introducing a topic, but we keep talking about Shibuya and Akihabara and all these places, and the tourists really have made these places
uninhabitable.
Uninhabitable. And so the thing, like a couple of years ago, I just started making a really conscious effort to not go to Shinjuku, Shibuya, Akihabara, and it's fine. Tokyo has so many places, like you don't have to go.
Well,
to
and even
places.
Even within Shibuya, go to Shinsen. Do you know what I mean? Like go a little bit away. It really is centralized in a couple of very specific areas. But if you go around, you know, Yanaka, and even like in Yanaka is a pretty well known place, but not nearly as much as like Shibuya. You can definitely find places where there aren't or aren't overrun.
Totally. I think the top five guidebook famous places are pretty much done. Like it's really hard to go there. And then I would say that any restaurant with any kind of fame is basically impossible.
Yeah, I don't even bother.
Especially on weekends. And it's not even because of foreigners, like everyone in Japan. Like social media has just made it where there's like a place in, I guess it's Toranomon. It's kind of in between Toranomon and Shinbashi that it's called Hekaloon. And it's like a kisa that does this pudding. And I think it was on TikTok or something, but now there's like a line of 50 to 100 people every day trying to get the pudding. And it used to just be like a neighborhood place that had pudding. And the guy who runs the store is like 75 or 80 or something. And he doesn't even have a smartphone. He has no idea why this is happening and he's cool with it. But you know, you can't go there anymore, more or less. Or if you go in the afternoon, once the puddings are sold out, you can get in and it's fine.
I don't remember Tokyo being like this pre-pandemic where like, if it's a Friday or Saturday night, if I don't have a reservation, I'm screwed. Like you literally have to plan so far in advance, and it was not like this even 4 or 5 years ago.
No way. You could totally, especially if you're talking chain places and things like that. The ironic thing is my friends who visit from abroad come like with these lists of restaurants I've never heard of.
Moss Burger.
Yeah, Moss Burger, you know, McDonald's. I'd never heard of this place before. They actually end up dragging me out to these places that I would never have gone to otherwise because it doesn't occur to me to go downtown. Like there's so many neighborhood joints that serve up really good quality food. Really, if you live here, you don't have to go to the places that are big on TikTok or whatever. I think that's a big difference.
And that's my advice. That's my advice to people coming here is like, don't sweat over, I got to go to this restaurant for tonkatsu because there's literally like another tonkatsu place down the street and it'll be just as good.
What about my likes? What about my engagement?
What about status and culture?
What about Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
There's an example of a place. You know, is that place even still there? I mean, it must be. Is Jiro still there?
We should call him up. Say, Jiro, what's up?
Well, you need your concierge at your hotel to get it.
Exactly. So all that stuff is new for the city, but you can kind of maneuver around it. It's, I mean, I think Star Bar is one. Is that the one you used to go to?
Well, Star Bar, those Ginza bars are like, yeah, I guess they are getting overrun. I don't know how the bars are dealing with it because the real Ginza bars are just not suited at all for tourists, and tourists have no idea what they're about. So like, why is it taking an hour to get this drink out or like whatever? And like, the one that I always hear is like, why are they just using all like, you know, off the shelf liquor instead of like fat washed infusions. And I'm like, that's what Ginza bars are about, man.
This Manhattan is too
classic. I haven't been going out because my favorite place, like Trench got so overrun, they had to open like an entire another bar down the street. And it's just really, the main one's still cool, but I don't know. Just a lot of these bars where I went to, they were quiet. They're not quiet anymore. And they're full of people. And so you just have to kind of seek out new places, I guess.
This is why I drink in front of the kombini until I get on the news as like a nuisance foreigner who leaves trash everywhere and pees in the street.
Yeah, at least you're not getting deported like certain other influencers are.
Yeah, no, look, there are so many bars and restaurants in Tokyo that if your favorite gets overrun, you can just move to another one and it will be okay. And that one will probably get overrun too at some point. But it's definitely, I'm hearing from friends that they're not sharing online any of their favorite places anymore. Because it's too dangerous.
You know, do they even have like newspaper based or, you know, food reviewers here in Japan? I don't ever recall, you know, every newspaper in the States has somebody who reviews the restaurants in that city, but there's just so many restaurants in Tokyo. I just don't think it would be possible.
Well, people on TV are always trying out foods and it's surprising because they always say it's delicious, no matter what. No one ever is like, oh, this is mid.
But the funny thing is if you actually go on one of those shows, which I have a long time ago, and you say anything else, they cut it. Those shows are completely edited. The reason you only hear Oishi is because anybody who says anything else or reacts even mildly to something just doesn't make the final cut. So
it's a conspiracy.
It is. I was made to eat corn potage gari gari kun on camera, and it does not taste. It tastes like frozen soup.
Well, you have to explain. Yeah, you have to explain that gari-gari-kun is supposed to be a dessert.
Yes, gari-gari-kun.
It's a high-end dessert that's only served in certain places in the Ginza. You have to get a reservation a few months ahead of time to eat one.
Like 60 yen.
Didn't they just raise the price to like 65 yen or something and it was national news?
Yes, and there's riots.
Gari-gari-kun are the cheapest popsicles in Japan.
So you're saying there was a corn potage flavor and it wasn't good.
I had to eat it on camera and I said something like, oh, omoshiroi desu ne, and they just cut that right out.
They're like, no. You had a script, stick
exactly.
to it.
Exactly. It's like, can I have like a hot pot to warm this up and drink it as actual warm soup? Maybe that would be better. I don't know. Anyway, those shows are not set up to be critical in any way, shape, or form. I think, you know, it's sometimes I hear from foreign people, like, man, I hate Japanese TV. It's stupid. Everybody just says oishii all the time. But it's like, they don't understand those shows are not set up to be any kind of deep dive on anything. They're supposed to set up a situation where you have kind of faux buddies around you and you're part of like a friend group that's going out on the town or something and you're just kind of tagging along. It's a very different mindset to like American reality shows where people are killing each other on camera, you know, or doing whatever. They're getting angry.
I'm not here to make friends.
Also, the average viewer is like 75 years old.
Just like newspapers here in Japan.
And it's on a TV in a local eatery with the sound off.
Actually, isn't the average age of Tokyo Scope listeners 75? I think so.
They would not get your references. It would blow their mind to listen to this podcast.
Wow, things are so cutting edge with all of Matt's 1980s and early 90s references.
Has the strange behavior of Margaret Mead, do you think that's because she's been listening to Tokyo Scope?
It's entirely possible. I often wonder how much of an effect we have on anthropologists.
That's a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas reference. I just reread that book, and this is about the fourth or fifth time I've read this book, because it's short and it's pretty fun. And I still think it's really funny, but it was the first time I realized the whole book is like a put on. Like, he did not do all those drugs. Like, it's just a joke about what if somebody did all these drugs.
Okay, what's your what triggered you to this epiphany?
Adrenochrome?
Yeah, well, the adrenochrome is like the really clear part where he's making something up. But like, I think all the drug combinations scientifically like would not work.
Well, I don't know. The guy was certainly drinking a lot of alcohol at the time.
Oh, I think he was really drunk. I think it was mostly that he was very drunk in Las Vegas, probably dabbling in some of the other stuff. But the idea that they were just like, now here's the ether, and now I just did a little bit more mescaline on top of the LSD.
Do you want to put like a controversy section on Wikipedia for the book?
That book is the classic, like, he wrote himself into a corner where like he had to live up to that stereotype for the rest of his life.
Yes. And if you read Hell's Angels, which is the book before, it's like a really good ethnography of the Hell's Angels. It's still like a wild book for someone to, you know, he gets beat up at the end by the Hell's Angels, but it's not as self-parody.
It's not self-parody at all. And also you can kind of read it. Doesn't it intertwine with not the Pump House Boys? Is it cool? Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test?
Yeah, because there was a scene where the Hells Angels show up with Kim Casey, and Tom Wolfe didn't have very good notes, and so he asked Hunter Thompson for his notes, and then he just wrote it based off of that. That's why there's like so much.
Right. Well, I mean, Hunter S. Thompson actually shows up in Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, doesn't he? I think he wrote him in as he's mentioned as being in there, I think.
He's mentioned because they were both there at that party, because it was supposed to be this big deal. Is this really what we're supposed to be talking about?
Is this like how Shakey's Pizza turns up in Pure Invention, Matt?
Yeah, you know, hey, come on. People come here for the deep dive.
And Ken Casey is supposed to meet the Hell's Angels, and it was supposed to be this huge kind of meeting between the subculture and the counterculture, and then it didn't. It kind of went well for one day, but then the Hell's Angels obviously turned on
the It's like when the TikTokers met like the Akihabara otaku who sat down alongside the fashionistas of Harajuku, and like the, you know, the clans made peace once again. Was that what it was like? No?
That was what it was supposed to be. And then the Hell's Angels stabbed somebody at Altamont, and that was it.
So. Well, that part won't happen among the Japanese subcultures. Probably. Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, the reason we're moving to these topics is because especially when Patrick and I talk, we just talk about the monkeys. Pretty much.
Or the Banana Splits.
And ELO. I firmly believe that Electric Light Orchestra is listened to more in Japan than anywhere else in the year.
I remember somebody, one of my good friends, my Japanese friends, and this was early when I came here in the early 2000s, like, Electric Light Orchestra, man, they're the best, right? Right? And at that time, I had not like had my big reacquaintance with Electric Light Orchestra. And I was like, ELO, what?
Living Thing? Evil Woman? When I first started getting back into vinyl records, I went to a local Hard Off and they had like literally every single ELO album someone had like thrown at them, like it was a thrift store. And they had never been played. There are so many used records here, like have literally never been played. I think it was a status thing in Japan. People would just buy these records. Like they say now, Taylor Swift is the biggest mover of vinyl in America. Like one out of every 10 records sold in America is a Taylor Swift record bought by someone who doesn't own a turntable.
Well, also because it's just collectorism. And so you're not really a fan of ELO unless you have all the physical albums. And so people would get it and then maybe, I don't know, tape it or something. I don't know.
I was listening to ELO before Anno Hideaki put it into the Daikon 4 video.
I was into ELO before it was cool, man. Has anyone ever said that?
Well, it's just part of that kind of 70s wave of music that was never cool to start with. ELO and Rush and Yes. Yes was never cool. It's good, but it's never
cool. You saying Badfinger was never cool, Marksy?
And Badfinger also was never cool, even though it's kind of cool and it's good.
Is that Breaking Bad uses a Badfinger song?
Something like that.
Yeah, that was no spoilers. You just spoiled what the final song of that was.
I just spoiled the movie preview because they used Mr. Blue Sky by ELO in it.
You spoiled that Volkswagen ad that you had Mr. Blue Sky in it. I think that's why ELO had a big resurgence, by the way. It's like
Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Opened up with it. It's like it didn't work at all. It was like the most unearned, like, you know, now modern movies have the most unearned, you know, pop music references in them.
I just saw The Killer, the David Finch film, which is all the Smiths and I guess Morrissey on the soundtrack. And that also is just like, this is so.
Well, it's a very well made and very like thin movie. It's just like there's not a lot of there, which I guess is supposed to be a.
No, can you imagine watching it twice? Like, you would just be like, oh, yeah, I remember when this
really didn't like happen it. Either. That's the problem. You haven't watched it three times yet.
Yeah.
Someone's got to make like a fan edit where they play like Chibo Matto instead of the Smiths every time he's about to kill someone.
But that would be so much cooler than just this. Like the Smiths, we already know that's a cool band. It's not like excavating something where he's really into Yola Tango. And then we're like,
well, I almost saw it as a form of like, it's like a business performance art. Like, look, we licensed all of this. Did you ever see the series Netflix Russian Doll? Like the first series had all of this kind of like really funky, you know, weird musical tracks that they were using. And then like it hit big. And then the second one is all just like super like radio hits and it just didn't have any vibes to it at all. I don't know.
No, Drake had done this song using One More Time by Daft Punk that was really terrible. But in some of it, it's like a status symbol. Like, we have so much money we can license.
Was that Drake or was that Kanye? Who was that?
No, it was Drake. Well, no, because Kanye had done a different
Daft Punk. It's like, who samples the sampler? You know,
that's where we are exhausted.
I'm just so tired. I'm so tired from all these pop cultural references.
Yeah, but okay. So just to end on a positive note, like, what are you into lately that you can tell us about? Something that it can be old, it can be new, it can be Japanese. But I mean, like, what's making you happy these days? Because there is a lot to kind of worry about here on the horizon, beginning of 2024. An election year. A new Godzilla movie is coming out from Legendary Studios. I'm very worried about that.
I'm less worried about that. And by the way, we didn't talk about, you and I both wrote for the Washington Post book review section. And it's because I intentionally said, don't send something to Matt Ault. And that was the first thing I said.
That's my hometown paper, guys. I can't believe it.
They asked me to review Godzilla novels. And I was like, absolutely not. I have no, I'm the worst person for this. And I was like, I know the perfect person for this.
No, no. Patrick was the perfect person for this.
And like, it came out like a week before Godzilla Minus One. Like, I had nothing to say about Godzilla Minus One. No one had seen it. And then like a week later, like, Godzilla Minus One is like the biggest movie on the planet. Like,
the National Review has covered Godzilla Minus One twice. That's crazy.
What about Popeye Magazine? Has Popeye Magazine covered Godzilla Minus One yet?
Are we going to go see the black and white version? Anyway, no, we cut David off. What do you like?
So this is the thing. I complain in a macro sense about culture, but in a micro sense, I think especially living in Japan, like, I am constantly excited about walking around the city. There's always new stuff. The whole Asakusa-bashi Kuramae area is like coming up. And like every time I go there, there's like some new store. That is all exciting. There's so much good clothing still being made in Japan. It's just constant. There's great stuff. The food, the coffee, everything's great. So I don't know. I think like on a daily basis, the things that I am into, I get access to good stuff that keeps me stimulated. I'm writing a new book. I just announced I'm writing a cultural history of the 21st century, and I'm going back right now and kind of like looking at the moment, you know, 2001 to 2005-ish. And it's been interesting just to go back and see all that stuff with the perspective of now. And so people like Pharrell and Kanye and Vice Magazine and Gavin McInnes and all. Yeah, I mean, there's just like all these people who were the kind of breakout stars of that era have had a lot of impact on the world, and for good or for bad. I'm into writing that book.
Wait, what is your organizing theme? Or like, are you going by like decade? Are you going by like some kind of pop culture? What's your lens? How are you organizing it?
And how much Jersey Shore will be in the book? Like an entire chapter, two chapters?
I'm about to hit Jersey Shore, but the problem of writing like a global cultural history is, you know, what to include. And I think the general sense is it has to be something that hopped out of its own original ecosystem to kind of influence outside of that. So American culture just usually crosses that standard because a Hollywood film is being seen everywhere. So like Inglourious Basterds or something is like not just a film that is popular in the United States, where a Bollywood film could be big in Indonesia or something, but generally, you know, it stays within its initial realm. K-pop has gone global, so K-pop obviously gets included. So I'm kind of working that out. And the other thing is that the story starts in a way that's so white and male and American. And then I think, you know, in the last 25 years, it really has diversified out. So tracking that, but basically it's like, I have these five themes that I won't go into at the moment, but you know, five kind of major shifts and looking at the record and telling the story kind of chronologically of how we got to where we are now. So it's not just random. Here's the stuff that happened. It kind of, the idea is to have some themes to move you along, but you know, I am looking at all these things that I completely forgotten about. Like when Ashley Simpson was on Saturday Night Live and the lip syncing skipped or whatever. It's just like, I haven't thought about that. And I don't know.
Ashley Simpson. Wow. That's a blast from the past.
Not even Jessica Simpson, but Ashley Simpson.
Or OJ Simpson. Right. Exactly.
Or Bart Simpson. Is
Bart Simpson. Do the Bart man. So I'm personally very motivated and excited about this year, but also, I don't know, just if, as long as you're not looking for the new stuff in Tokyo, it's still the best city in the world.
I would love to have you back on to talk about Kuremae and Asakusa-bashi, because those were the first neighborhoods I ever started exploring in Japan in like the early 90s. And they were just warehouse districts. That's actually the toy wholesale district, which is why I was like hanging out there. And you're right, like recently, and it was that way for decades. Like I never expected it to ever gentrify like it's been recently. So good thing, bad thing, I don't know thing.
Yeah, Asakusa-bashi was like the best kept secret for toy nerds for like decades.
Yes. Like, I just hope those places don't disappear. But I think they will, because they're run by like elderly people and I don't think their kids want to take over.
I mean, what's interesting about it now is that there are the cool stores, but then, you know, there's 40 like just normal people's houses in between them.
Yes.
Like it really is just a residential neighborhood in which there's like a cool cafe.
Well, that's where all those little like factories used to be, right?
And there's still some, you know, leather suppliers, and I think the shoe supply district is there, but it can't gentrify overnight, and it will never be a place where I think like tons of tourists go out to, because it's just still pretty remote.
Right. You basically have to either take a long walk from Akihabara, which takes you down that awesome section of tracks, which has that coffee shop smell. It's called the smell. And all of these other like little like dingy nicotine stained eateries and things like that. But I guess since we're wrapping this up, I'll say, just to kind of echo what you're talking about, I just love that there's still like weird stuff to discover out there, like old stuff and new stuff.
Tokyo is so massive. And I, you know, especially during pandemic, one of the few things that I was able to do was just like walk around. And I would do these, you know, 20 kilometer walks, or I did like a 45 kilometer walk once, which was totally insane. But when I started walking around, I started charting kind of where I had been and where I had not been. And I started to try to map it to be a completist and like go everywhere. And it's basically impossible. Like there's no way in Tokyo you can go everywhere. It's all way too much landmass. And that's exciting. Like just this feeling that you can never quite get all of it.
The sprawl. Chiba City. Maybe Chiba City is next. Maybe, you know.
Tokyo, Osaka, Kanagawa. We have to do like the Kokujin Tensai thing.
The Kokujin Tensai.
What is he up to?
I don't know. Actually, I wish I knew. I mean, Patrick interviewed him once years ago. I don't think he's dropped any new tracks recently.
He's on Spotify.
He did that Waruguchi Sensei, Patrick's favorite song.
Ketsutobi is actually my favorite song.
I mean this without sarcasm. If you were to write a book about kind of like the progression of Japanese culture globally, I would put him in there. I mean, that I think that was a big moment of like, there's some guy who is this deep into it and doesn't even live in Japan. So that was fascinating.
I actually really, really want to have him on. I think that'd be really funny if we could make contact with him.
Yeah, maybe 2024 is the year we will make contact with Kokujin Tensai.
I'm not even joking. We take him to Shakey's. Like, bring him, like, he comes, next time he comes to Japan, we all go to Shakey's.
Go fund me, Kokujin Tensai and Shakey's. Shakey's could sponsor
it. That you're trying to wrap this up, but I have to ask because I did go to Shakey's with you in the past, and there was the all-you-can-eat lunch buffet that people were very excited about, and I used to be very excited about. I don't think I could eat Shakey's anymore, and I'm not a snob at all. I eat a lot of things that are not good for me, but I don't think I could eat Shakey's. But how often do you go to Shakey's, for real?
I haven't been in a really long time. Patrick, was the last time we went together?
I must have been pre-pandemic. Maybe it's like 3 or 4 years ago, I think.
I did all this research for a Shakey's episode, and we were supposed to do it last year on their 50th, but you were too busy. And we didn't. I really think we should go back and do it because Shakey's is actually really interesting historically. It benefited from when they kind of allowed foreign companies to finally start investing over here.
And as I remind people, 38 times a day on average, I'm from Sacramento, the birthplace of Shakey's. So it's very special to me.
It is. It's part of your spiritual heritage, I think one could even say.
But to end on a high note, do you have a favorite Kokujin Tensai song, WD?
What's the Abarero? That's the only one I know.
Abarero. Yeah, what is it? I think it's called Abarero.
Yeah, that's the only one. Called Abarero. Yeah, you can end on that one.
Abarero, 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 Abarero. Ore to kenka yaru ki, dakara nanda moku ite yaru ki. Dakara nanda, mondai aru. Dakara nanda, dakara nanda, dakara nanda. Club ni haeru to mushaburi tsuku o kane nai nara, nai nara. Humikomu keisatsu dosuru, keisatsu dosuru. Achi ni ike, kiero, kaere. Doko da sake, doko da, doko da. Noro ga kawaita, doko da sake wa. Mishikenai to, mishikenai to. Moshiteru daro, moshiteru daro. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Ore to kenka yaru ki. Dakara nanda, moku ite yaru ki. Dakara nanda, mondai aru. Dakara nanda, dakara nanda, dakara nanda. Yato, sake nonda kero choto nomi sugichatta. Me no mae ni bijin bijin darashinai mesuki. Kanojo no tokoro ni ite, ite. Kono kotoba ore ga ite, ite. Sonna gakko de nanpa saratai daro. Nanpa shite ageyo, ageyo. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Ore to kenka yaru ki. Dakara nanda, moku ite yaru ki. Dakara nanda, mondai aru. Dakara nanda, dakara nanda, dakara nanda. Okoteru ka? Dakara nanda, mukatsuku ka? Dakara nanda, omae no koto dou demo ii. Omae no koto dou demo ii. Ore to kenka shitai nara, koko ni koi. Koko ni koi, koko ni koi. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Abarero, abarero. Ore to kenka yaru ki. Dakara nanda, moku ite yaru ki. Dakara nanda, mondai aru. Dakara nanda, dakara nanda, dakara nanda. Okoteru ka? Dakara nanda, mukatsuku ka? Dakara nanda, omae no koto dou demo ii. Omae no koto dou demo ii. Ore to kenka shitai nara, koko ni koi. Koko ni koi. abarero, 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 abarero. Ore soken ka yaru ki, dakara nanda moku ite yaru ki, dakara nanda mondai aru, dakara nanda, dakara nanda, dakara nanda. Dakara nanda.